Hi, I'm David Brothers, co-host of the Mangasplaining podcast. I want to open this episode with a disclaimer. We had a slight snafu while recording this one, so the audio quality isn't up to what we usually aim for. Please bear with us for this one. The conversation about Mermaid Saga is a pretty good one, and it's well worth your time. Anyway, and now, Mangasplaining.
Welcome to Mangasplaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read manga before. Hosted by Deb Aoki, David Brothers, myself, Christopher Butcher, and Chip Zdarsky. Follow along with our reading list at mangasplaining.com.
Hi, my name is Deb Aoki, and this week's episode of Mangasplaining, we are going to be talking about one of the all-time great manga creators, Rumiko Takahashi. And Rumiko Takahashi has been honored as one of the most successful manga creators in the world, not only in Japan, but throughout Europe, in South America. She's very well known. She's published a lot of different manga that are very, very popular and very, very long. Well, you could argue that, you know, introducing Rumiko Takahashi to someone new to manga, you would say, oh, read Ranma One Half, that goofy manga about gender bending and kung fu. And you would not be wrong, except Ranma One Half is like 40-something volumes. You could say, well, why not introduce him to Inuyasha, one of the most popular manga that is an anime that's been around, where there's this guy with like little white ears, and it's like he's always yelling at this girl Kagome, and they fight and they have giant knives and stuff like that. You would not be wrong either, except Inuyasha is, I think, 70-something volumes. So, in light of trying to get into Rumiko Takahashi, but in a little more low-key way, we are going to be talking about Mermaid Saga. Mermaid Saga was originally published as 3 volumes, but now Viz Media is putting them out as 2 volumes. The other interesting thing about Mermaid Saga is that it is a horror series. A lot of Rumiko Takahashi's work, like Ranma One Half, Urusei Yatsura, a lot of it's comedies, but Mermaid Saga is actually a drama. It's a horror story. There's still some touches of humor in there, but it is largely a horror story about a young man who becomes immortal when he eats the flesh of a mermaid. And he meets other people who are either also immortal or trying to become immortal or cursed by the mermaid. But by the curse of the mermaid. Anyway, it's kind of like a folk tale about eating a mermaid's flesh gives you immortality. So anyway, let's see. I mean, there's a lot to say about Rumiko Takahashi. I mean, I think a lot of people talk about her work as being kind of a gateway drug to manga. Chris, David, how did you get introduced to Rumiko Takahashi?
I'll jump in. Actually, Ranma in anime was the first anime that really grabbed me after Akira. I think I mentioned a couple episodes ago, you know, I had friends when I was young. They pretended to be university students, started tape trading with university students. They were like 12. Got a bunch of videos. And the one that I really loved of all the stuff that we watched was Ranma. And it was so fun. It was funny. The martial arts were really good. It was a little bit naughty because it had lots of boob jokes, which was good. And that was the one that like really grabbed me. Then I actually discovered that there were Ranma comics. So I would go to the comic book store and, you know, buy stuff. But it was all Marvel superheroes and Transformers. And I would be like, oh, there's comics of this. And I would read a couple here or there, or the other Viz comics that were coming out. Sometimes the Mermaid Saga, which was Mermaid Forest, I think, at that point. Sometimes Maison Okoku, which I also liked. But yeah, I really loved the anime, and I was like, this person is someone to watch. And I was really actually taken by the fact that it was a woman who was making it and had like, you know, it was just so unique based on everything else I was reading at the time that I couldn't not like it. So that was my introduction, Rumiko Takahashi. David, how about yours?
Mine's pretty similar. I should probably lead with like a huge conflict of interest disclaimer.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. It'll be fine, right?
Yeah, sure.
But so when I, similarly, like I saw Akira as a kid, Vampire Hunter D, Fist of the North Star, and later, once I could rent videotapes on my own, I rented Ranma One Half. I think it was Nihao My Concubine, or one of like the movies.
Yeah.
So I'd never seen the series in its entirety, just like two or three 45-minute like clip shows, or clips rather. And I really enjoyed it. Like, I thought the fighting was really funny. The action was good. It was exciting that there was nudity.
Yeah.
Because obviously, like, being a teenager in the 90s. And I didn't know that she did comics for a very long time until after I saw Inuyasha on Adult Swim. And, like, after I found out she did comics, like, it suddenly made a lot more sense why her work was so good. Because the anime is great, but her comics are even better. Like, her comic timing is exquisite.
Yeah.
How much input does she have on the anime?
I think usually they'll follow the path she set down, but she doesn't actually write episodes or direct anything.
Okay.
So it's sort of like they option it and go off and do their thing, because there's like this whole apparatus for turning manga into anime.
Yeah.
And so I imagine they'll run things by her, but they'll do episodes that are just like not from the manga at all. Hmm. Like entirely new.
Basically, I mean, she's doing a 20-something pages a week. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's all this stuff that's happening around her work. That's like, there was a Rumiko Takahashi pop-up cafe in Japan. There was like the anime series. There's all this other stuff. And it's just like, I think the mangaka would love to be more involved, but at a certain point, they just realized it's not going to happen. Like, my time has to be spent at the drawing board creating new things that they will turn into cafes and anime. So yeah, I think she's aware of everything, but I know she works really closely with her editor and her editorial team. And it's, I would say nothing happens that she isn't on board with, but she doesn't like do it all anymore. That's for sure.
Yeah.
And she's not that old. I think she's maybe in her mid to late 60s at this point. She got a very early start in her career in the 70s, I think, as a teenager.
Mm. Yeah, she's 63.
And I think, like Chris, you'd mentioned earlier that she was an assistant, or she learned from Kazuko Ike.
So, yeah, right before she made her professional debut with like an early version of Lum, she took a class by Kazuo Koike, who made L'Enfant von Cub, which I think, Chip, you're familiar with that, with L'Enfant von Cub, right? You're not that unlearned.
Okay, here's how I learned about L'Enfant von Cub. It was a single page gag in Marvel's What the?
Yeah.
And it was like Lone Wolvie and Chris, and it was Chris Claremont in Wolverine's backpack. And it's just like, it was all dialogue, because it was making fun of Chris Claremont. That's how I found out about Lone Wolf and Cub. And then later on, when I shared a studio with Kagan McLeod, he had all the volumes. And he would show me stuff in them, but I never actually made my way through them.
Maybe one day. But yeah, I found that out, and I was like, oh, that's really surprising. But I'd heard, she's never confirmed this, which makes this like an urban legend, but I'd heard that she never assisted Koike. She like was instructed by him right before she broke in, and then obviously stopped going to school because she's got a Shonen Sunday deal. But I heard that she assisted the creator of Cat-Eyed Boy, Mezu, Kazuo Mezu, who does like the horror comic, like the Japanese horror master. And she was an assistant. She's never confirmed it, but everyone knows this. She's never denied it either. So it's not part of her official bio anywhere. But I was really struck by that while reading Mermaid Saga, actually, is how much it felt like certain kinds of Mezu horror stories, particularly Cat-Eyed Boy, like the really episodic stuff. But I've accidentally segued into Mermaid Saga. Oh, no.
What's the order in her career? Because I'm familiar with Ranma, I'm familiar with Maison no Kuku, and those have a lot more similarities than this. So where does this fall in her publishing?
I think it's after that.
Actually happened. She was working on this simultaneously with Ranma.
Simultaneously.
Yeah. So she would be doing Ranma, and then once this appeared, I think, in a monthly magazine, whereas Ranma was weekly. But before that was Maison no Kuku. And before that, her first really big series was Yurusei Yatsura, Lum, which is also getting a simultaneous release in big oversized formats from Viz right now, which is interesting. Ranma is the odd one out, where the like version that they came up with during the Tokyo Pop boom years is the version that's still in print, whereas everything else is slowly getting turned into like big editions or reprints with color pages or that kind of thing. So this is actually this is simultaneous with Ranma, and it's I would say it's an early work, especially when you look at her most recent work. This is, there's a lot of different stuff going on here. And I think she's hues closer to her influences on this than I see a lot of Koiki. I see a lot of Umezu. I see a lot of early shonen stuff and Adachi, actually less soft than Mitsuru Adachi's work. But
yeah, I see all that too.
All right, got up my own ass.
Good job with the introduction to manga podcast, Chris.
The show notes are going to be 800 words long.
Right?
But he's right. Like, there's really Takahashi's like a Hall of Fame creator, and I think that it kind of shows in what Chris is talking about, that she has these influences and peers and artists working in similar modes that are just as kind of legendary. So, like, she's in really good company, basically.
Yeah.
And it's cool to see an earlier work like this. I think this was, like, 87, something like that. 84. So this...
84. Yeah, this, I think it's, like, it was I think that the two books in the Mermaid Saga were published over a period of 10 years. Mm-hmm. 84 to 94.
Yep. Whenever she felt like doing an extra story that month, we got a Mermaid Saga story. But she's also done, by the way, tons of other short stories. Some of which have been reprinted in North America and some of which haven't, in addition to her huge, long, epic, like, she hasn't, I think she took, like, 2 months off, but in all that time, she's had an ongoing, like, weekly serialization in Shonen Sunday magazine since the 80s, different series each time.
Yeah. Sorry, pardon me for just 1 second, I'm just looking up Rumiko Takahashi's net worth.
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's like
$70 million. $70 million.
That's pretty good for Japan. Their salary.
But she has 1, 2, 3. She has 4 series that are over 35 volumes. Okay. So, like, she's done a ton of work to make that $70 million.
I had a concluding statement that I was going to go for, but I was doing some quick back of the envelope, as we say, math. I think she's the most published Japanese cartoonist in English. I think there are more pages of Rumiko Takahashi work in print right now than any other cartoonist in English. And I'm talking not just manga, but, like, she's got maybe 4,000 or 5,000 pages of in-print comics. Even Kirby's is, like, not quite as in-print as Rumiko Takahashi's of, you know? It's a little bit crazy.
It makes sense because she's one of the only creators that have actually read her stuff.
Yeah, she crossed over.
Yeah. And it's so accessible. Like, it's unbelievably accessible work.
You mean that in a literal sense, like easy to find, or also in terms of like being a reader and like getting hooked into the story?
Being a reader and getting hooked. Like, I enjoyed the ones I read when I was in high school. And I kind of thought going into this that maybe the sheen would be off because my memories were so positive in high school. But it grabbed me quicker than our previous two books.
Mm. Really?
Oh, really? Right off the bat, eh?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, 100%. Like, we can get into it in terms of the the review and the book discussion. But it's, I can't actually recall reading a comic that grabbed me and surprised me as continuously as this one did, like ever. Ooh. Like, I was pleasantly surprised by this.
Wow.
And you had never read this before, right? This is your first time reading this.
This is my first time reading it. It did bring back memories of Ranma and Maison no Kuku, for sure. Because I remember those being like, oh, they're page turners. They're real page turners. And this one lived up to that. You look gobsmacked, Chris.
Yeah, I'm happy. I think it speaks to just how strong a creator she is. But for this, and I really liked huge aspects of this, but I got to the end of it and I was like, it made me want to read other comics by her I liked more. Yeah. So I'm kind of shocked that you liked it so much.
I can see it. Like, by the end, I'm like, okay, I did want to find out what happened, but I was like just thoroughly entertained by this that I don't actually feel the need to keep going, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It does make me want to read her other works.
It is interesting the way that the Mermaid Saga is structured is that every one of these chapters could be a standalone story. Mm-hmm. It, you know, like you could finish it and then he could finish it and walk away and go like, yeah, you know, that was a kind of satisfying ending to these characters' adventure. Like,
yeah.
And you wouldn't feel sad about like, oh, what's going to happen next to them next? Although, you know, the story does build a little bit. Like you see the character of Yuta and Mana, and, you know, their relationship grows a little bit. But
yeah.
And but it's not like it's not as dependent on backstory as, say, like your One Piece. Like One Piece builds and builds and builds and builds and builds with characters and backstory and things that just kind of come out, and it becomes this very multi-layered story. This is just kind of like Master Keaton, which is by Naoki Urasawa, which is kind of like you have a premise, here's the story, here's the character in a certain in a new story, and then it ties it up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so this makes it very, you know, easy to get into because you're not on the hook for, you know, volumes and volumes of story.
Yeah, what I liked about the multiple story kind of format of this was she played with the immortality of the characters and bounced around in time. Mm-hmm. Like that's the kind of thing that really fascinates me as a reader and as a writer. Like, you know, not a plug for my own book, but I'm working on a book that's called Stillwater. That's about a town where you can't die.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So I that's why I thought you picked it for me. I'm reading this. I'm like, wait a second.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I'm trying to figure out ways to kind of bounce around in time to tell the story. And so with this, I was both kind of elated to see it done so well, but also it kind of crushed me a little bit because I'm not going to hit these heights. Which is kind of the problem I have reading most comics. With the comics I read, I'm either like, oh, that's a shitty comic. Well, at least I'm better than that. Or that's an amazing comic. I'll never be as good as that. And this
no
is
in between.
Very rarely.
Yeah. No, I agree with what you're saying about how it's cool. She kind of variations on a theme are always really interesting to me, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Like when an artist keeps plugging at the same idea or same kind of concept over and over, but slightly different each time. Because I'll confess, I didn't realize that it was the same Yuta in the first couple of stories. Because I was like, oh, okay. Like this is a new chapter. This must be a new guy. And she's just reusing the name. And I was like, no, that's dumb. Like it's definitely yeah. more. But it took to see him like shift that way.
Yeah, it took me a few pages to realize that as well.
Yeah.
And then you catch up and you're like, oh, okay. Yeah, that actually adds like another like element of depth to the story, just kind of already knowing the previous adventure and the previous time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she's the kind of artist that has kind of a what do they call it? Tezuka had like a constellation of characters, like different faces that he would reuse and in different stories.
A house style.
Yeah. And she definitely does the same thing where some characters I'm like, oh well, like this one's Ranma, you know?
Yeah. like this one's Ranma, and then oh, he's wandering. Maybe it's Ryoga who with a headband. Yeah, I was a little thrown back. The first time something really outlandishly violent happened, I was like, holy shit, what's happening in Ranma? And I was like, no, you're not watching. This isn't Ranma. This is the Mermaid Saga, and outlandishly violent shit's going to happen.
Yeah. She still has a few good funny bits in there, here and there.
Oh, yeah.
You should all be eating.
Yeah, especially.
Yeah, there's the... Like one of my favorite parts, I think comedy hits harder when you go a long time without it in a story. And there's a scene, I think it was in the present day, where Yuta's going on about, you know, his past or whatever. And he says, you know, I must be boring you. And Mana goes, yep, and walks away. it's such a perfect bit of comedy. And I don't know how much of that is Takahashi and how much of it is the translator.
Yeah,
it's so perfect, especially after everything that's happened and like, you know, these kind of wild adventures and stuff, and this bond. She's like, "Yep," walks away.
I think it is her, but I will give a shout out to Rachel Thorne who translated this.
Rachel's awesome.
Series, and Rachel has a really wonderful way of doing conversational, you know, translation where you're not taken out of the story.
Yeah.
It feels very natural how they're speaking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like this compared to, Delicious in Dungeons, Like, obviously, Delicious in Dungeons, there's a lot more kind of fun comedy bits, but I also found I couldn't tell if the translation was not as good. Like there's so many awkward kind of bits that I kind of kept having to go back over. But with this, it read so smoothly. So yeah, shout out to the translator, or shout out to Takahashi for the editor for like keeping it just kind of so tight, and yeah, nothing felt like it was an awkward translation, you know?
It's very nice.
Yeah, very smooth. And you know, also compared to Akira, now that I know that this is a thing that happens in manga, see, I'm learning.
What did you learn?
The opening painted parts. Mm. or when she would use the ink wash. It's very beautiful in this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like it's really, really well done.
The color pages, she's phenomenal. She's so, so good. And there was actually, I was surprised about that because Viz went to great lengths to reprint even mid-book pages in full color. Mm-hmm. And they're beautiful. Like, they're really gorgeous.
Some of them aren't. Like, there's a one section where it looks like it's supposed to be color. It looks really muddy.
So it goes from color to this muddy black and white. And I can't tell if that was because... So there's a thing in her work, and you don't really see it till you get to Japan, but they'll do pages in color, but they'll also do pages in one color. So it'll be black ink, but then they'll do like an orange wash at different... Mm-hmm. Orange is a popular color for it. And it kind of looks a little bit like that, because it looks like it's tones, but it looks muddy. And maybe just the original orange wasn't available, or it was in full color and they couldn't get the files or something. But it's a weird... There's a weird segment at the beginning of the Mermaid Forest section that is a little muddy and repro. Did you notice? Did it throw you out, or were you like, not fine?
I just thought it was kind of like a darker feel to it. I'm trying to kind of call it back up again.
Oh, it's page. I was just there. Pages like 163, 164, 165 in the printed version. The black is really sharp, really beautifully printed, actually. But yeah, the grays there do come across as a little muddy. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think it's definitely the one color, sort of like how Darwin Cook did the Parker books, like with the
blue
and that kind of thing. Because it's an easy way to make your pages like a little more exciting in serialization, but then it creates a problem when you've collected it, especially for an older series. Like, I can't imagine the original files for this are still kicking around.
So I think.
Looking at this too, it's I forget the name of the type of paper, but you can see that the type of it's not what Takahashi actually painted on.
Oh, it has that kind of that little that line quality.
Like the texture is really nice.
Yeah, it's really nice, but it's also that's what kind of gives it that kind of muddiness, I think, as well, because there's a lot of bleed happening there, and. And part of the problem is too, just like to make the black line crisper. Usually, you do that on a separate layer.
Yeah.
Like one of my first jobs was doing a comic for a newspaper, where I had to like do all the black line on like semi-transparent sheets, and then I do the color or the gray. Like underneath it, like I'd always have to flip back and forth like an animator to make it line up, and they'd run those through the press separately. And in this case, like she's clearly done it all on that paper, which has a very bleeding line, which is definitely jarring, especially when you put the text over it, because the text is always really sharp.
100% black.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I like the little things like that, especially with older manga, where you can kind of see the hand of the creator, like on the page.
Yeah.
Even if it's, you know, an imperfection or something like that. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I still feel like drawings are one of the coolest things in the world. Because juvenile as that sounds, like, it's awesome, you know? Mm-hmm. And having, like, that minor connection with, like, oh, Takahashi was probably doing it like this. Like, seeing the brushwork, seeing the strokes in the art in some of the paintings.
Yeah.
There's something like infinitely cool about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels more tangible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do like it.
And I imagine it would look different on paper versus digital, like whatever the original paperback was.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So,
Did you find that you liked the episodic nature of it, Chip, or did you want there to be a more sustained narrative with the characters?
I think there was a sustained narrative. Like, that's the thing. Like, even though it was, you know, episodic, like, the relationships between the characters grew and your understanding of them grew. So it still felt like one full story with the smaller stories kind of spread throughout. I thought it was a really fascinating way to do it. Like, what I'm taking from the books that we've read so far is all kind of towards my career. And like, this is a great example of like, oh, why wouldn't I just do like a whole arc? That's like a story set in a different time. And then the next arc is a story in another time, but we still have the same characters. Like, in my mind, I'm already lifting from these.
Oh, that's awesome.
Greatly. Like, but yesterday I was like, this is a weird thing to mention on a manga podcast. I should save it for our Miami Vice podcast. But I was watching the In the Air Tonight scene from Miami Vice from the pilot episode, which is a very lush, long, quiet scene, really set well to the music. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous scene, and it's so luxurious in the time that it takes. And I was talking to other North American comic creators about that and how I've had this feeling lately that I just want to like do a comic like that, which is like silence where you're just kind of moving through and just about the beauty of the scene. And one of them pointed out, he's like, you've been doing that manga podcast lately, haven't you? I'm like, oh yeah, of course. I just, you know, we just reviewed Akira, which has like these beautiful, lush, big shots and, you know, taking your time with stuff. And yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so this is affecting me too in a different way.
I think that happens to a lot of creators. I think that's why so many people got into manga. Like my introduction to manga was through my uncle, who was an artist. Like, he was not like professional, but like, he gave me comics. They were really dope. And it just kind of carried on in my life. And he liked it because it was something not like what he grew up on.
Yeah.
It's like, you know the Jack Kirby language really well, but now it's like Rumiko Takahashi dialect. Like, what is that like?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What kind of artist was your uncle?
Different than even... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Like, he moved into graphic design, but in high school, like, he drew image style.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Like a little Willis Portacio, maybe? I gotta see if there's any pages left.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. Like, when you see something that's really dope, you're like, this is really good. How can I make this work for me?
Yeah.
Even, like, not being an artist myself, like, I'm always looking for something to steal, like, in prose or in approach and tone.
Yeah.
Because in another universe, these are just like a Wolverine miniseries of him through the years.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah, right?
So when I went off on my tangent about like all the different artists that I felt like I was seeing a little bit of in Rumiko Takahashi's work, that is a little obtuse, but you've read three manga now. This is our third episode, or well, third and a half.
I've read three manga. Just look at me.
Pretty good. But you've read like, I don't know, I think we've read 600 pages of manga so far. So do you see more similarities between these works that we've read, these three works that you've read, or more differences between these three works that we've read? Like, I think David made a really good point about like Rumiko Takahashi is a dialect of comics, you know what I mean? And like, you know, you could say that about Kui Sensei or Otomo Sensei as well, but like, do they feel like they're part of a unit? Like, is this just, this is what Japanese comics are to you?
Not really. I mean, the similarities are just the fact that they're, you know, telling their own stories in a longish format. Which, you know, sounds like, well, isn't that stories? But having grown up in Marvel and DC stuff, no. You know, there wasn't a lot when I was growing up that had that feel. You know, it's different now with, you know, publishers like Image and Oni, you know, doing their own thing, not these shared universe to be turned into these shared universe movies. R.I.P. Bloodshot.
It's cold.
So it's fascinating to me to see creators maybe doing things like, I think the last two books felt like they're doing things that aren't necessarily going to be their life's work. but they're still really long and you know, well thought out, fun and interesting stories. Like Mermaid Saga, it feels like a detour for an artist. Like, oh, I'm going to do it's kind of a horror story, but I'm just kind of like making up some stuff about mermaids as I go along. You know, like, oh, all of a sudden Mermaid Ashes does this, and oh, guess what? Also mermaids bite humans, and this thing happens to them, and like kind of creating a mythology as she goes.
A part where someone's like, some mermaids have fins, some mermaids have two legs. I was like, then which was the mermaid part?
I know. Their insides are all fish.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can make up all kinds of things about mermaids, right? Like in One Piece, like the mermaids after a certain age grow legs.
Yeah. Right?
And then they look like old ladies.
So wait, are mermaids like a big part of manga? If it's also like in One Piece?
The immortality thing is an actual, like, it's folklore. Mm-hmm. Where if you eat the flesh of a mermaid, it gives you immortality. And I think because of that, it's made it into a lot of different manga.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also One Piece have fishmen that are like but human bodies.
Yeah. I mean, they're pirates. They're in the ocean, so mermaids are part of it.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's mermaids in a lot of manga.
Okay.
It just kind of... I thought that was really funny about it. It's like, I thought about how Japanese people have a different relationship with fish than American people do.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything is delicious to them, right? They can... I mean, if you've ever watched Iron Chef, half of the episodes are about different kinds of fish. So, like, yeah. I heard this joke once that someone said, oh, you know, when Japanese people go to an aquarium, they look and they think, ooh, I wonder what that one tastes like raw.
We went to, the first time we went to Japan, we went to there was an aquarium in Ikebukuro, and we went to it, and it was children's drawings up on the wall, and the prevailing theme of these children's drawings was like, we are going to eat all of these fish. Like, cat eating the fish, and you're like, okay, I kind of get it, and it's like just a beautiful fish, but it's on like a metal grill with fire under it, and you're going to grill this fish, and it was just like, yeah. So the idea of, I don't know, it seems... It's never presented as disgusting that you're going to eat this mermaid.
Exactly.
Everyone's like, with it.
There's this mermaid, this dead headless mermaid, like, it's been apparently rotting there for like hundreds of years. And they go, I'm going to eat it. It's like,
yeah,
I've had lutefisk. Not lutefisk is no big deal. I've had that rotten shark.
You had the shark head?
Oh, no, it's horrible.
Rotten shark.
Rotten shark.
Honestly, there's no hyperbole in that explanation.
It really is. It's putrid. I was the only one in my tour party who ate it, and everyone took great joy in filming me making faces. It was horrible.
But the mermaid thing does remind me, this book made me realize that immortality is often seen as a curse in manga, and I think a lot of Japanese pop culture. I'm playing this video game Sekiro, which has an immortal character. And he's like, being immortal was great until I got killed a bunch of times, and now I just want to die and like get out of this horrible cycle that I'm trapped in. And there's a lot of that in Mermaid Saga as well, where like immortality kind of ruins your life.
Yeah, and like, but yet there's still half the characters are trying to get it.
Yeah.
Right.
I thought it was kind of funny that it was like, oh, I'm immortal, and I've been looking 500 years. I've been, like, wandering Japan looking for mermaids, and I've never met anyone like me. And in the span of 250 pages, he meets, like, 8 people like him. Yeah. It's just like, glad the manga wasn't about those first 500 years. That would have been a different manga.
Yeah, 8 people like him and just mermaids showing up all over the place.
There's so many mermaids. There's one that's very far inland, like, nailed to a wall in a cave under a tree.
That was such a good moment. Like, you know, spoiling it for anyone reading it, but
spoilers.
You know, I mentioned earlier just like how often I was surprised in this, and that was a surprise too when they finally go up to it and it turns around and takes a bite.
Yeah,
I should have guessed. Like half of these, I'm just like, I don't know. Sometimes you see twists and surprises in stories where it's clearly just the author just like trying to surprise you, but it takes several leaps of logic to get there, and you just kind of roll your eyes at it. These are the ones where, and it would happen every couple of pages. Like it's quite astounding how often she manages to surprise you. And every time it happens, I'm just like, oh, of course.
Yeah.
See, that's really nice.
Of course she turns out to be a mermaid. Oh, of course, you know, they weren't actually dead. Even the moment when, what was it? Mona kills Isago? Is that her name?
Oh, the pirate lady? Yeah.
No, there are two shocking things. One, when Isago stabs her dad.
And it's like, I guess you better find the mermaid now, fucker. That was so good.
And I know. I was like, oh my God. And then the next page, Mana just kills her. Mm. I'm like, oh my God. And then it turns out she's not dead. I'm like, oh my God. That's three oh my gods in a row.
Yeah.
And how could I not see those coming based on what had happened before? But really, really impressive storytelling.
I'm so glad to hear that. It's hard for me to have a fresh take on it because I've read it so much.
Yeah, I think it'd be weird to reread it. I think so much of this is the freshness in discovering the mythologies and the surprises. Like the first story alone, with the old ladies, and they find out they all look exactly the same. All these weird little levels, and then he dies, but he's not dead. I'm like, what? What kind of what? This is a mermaid story? What's going on? There's a lot just crammed in there that I don't know how it would reread, you know?
The one that got me like that was with the two sisters, the twins, where one made the other immortal. And then the immortal one was like, I'm going to stay alive until I can make you immortal in revenge.
Yeah.
Yes. I know. That was quite the twist.
But so good.
I know. They're like, there were three twists to lead up to that twist, too.
Yeah.
It's like, mind-boggling. Yeah.
I will say I 100% agree with you. Those surprises were my favorite part. I was sitting reading next to Andrew, and every once in a while I'd be like, holy fuck! And he'd be like, what? And I'm like, oh, it's the book. And he's just it's simple stuff, too. You're talking about, oh, there's this monster in the forest, Big Eyes, we call him, and you finally get your first shot of him. His first shot, he's literally just pulling the head off a boar, straight up. And you're just like, what the fuck? It's so shocking. The things that happen that are shocking are legitimately shocking. The twists and turns. The big surprise at the end of the one after it turns out, she didn't get stabbed by the sword after all. That was just the real surprise stuff was good. But for me, it was the fact that the underlying stuff, I didn't feel as much attachment to the characters. I felt they weren't ciphers exactly, but they were definitely she had a folktale she wanted to tell, and she had her characters that you were on board with as the protagonists of the story. So I really enjoyed as I was reading it, but as I was done, I was I don't need to ever read anything with these characters again, but man, I could go for some Ranma or some cross game or something like that right now.
By the end of it, I was invested in Yuta and Mana and their relationship, as a romantic relationship, just how he was like, oh, you kind of like me by the end.
Yeah.
We went through all that to get to, you kind of like me. no, not really. I do want to see what happens with those characters. Mm. And Yuta's character really only kind of came into focus at the end with Nei, that whole story and meeting in the cherry fields or whatever. Mm-hmm. That was a really elegantly drawn and told scene at the end with them. It's funny to go through the whole book and basically that last story was the one that made me go, okay, yeah, I would want to check out volume two.
And that's another one that's full of wild twists. The kid, I love the drawing of Sokichiro, the kid with the unibrow. A child and an adult, and Takahashi is so good at that kind of thing.
Yeah, you could immediately tell that the kid that was that character as a kid.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That was really perfect. Just an old man kid. Just always funny.
Yeah,
yeah. Very extremely well done. I would be perfectly happy if the rest of the books that we read were Takahashi books.
Well, there's enough to where we can make that happen.
Actually, one more question about art, because this is something... Disclosure, I used to work for Viz for a little bit. A thing I would hear a lot is, not specifically about Takahashi-sensei, but anything that was older than even like 5, maybe 10 years, we would get back, the art looks old, and so we can't license it, or it's more difficult, or the audience won't, you know, gravitate to it. Did you feel at any point like this was a product of a different time? Like, could this have been a contemporary manga for you? Did it feel out of place?
Well, disclaimer, I'm going to work for Viz in the future, but I don't know. Let's just all say we work for Viz.
Yeah.
I don't instantly recognize it as being dated or of a time, but it's because I don't have a lot of experience. But as soon as you say it, I'm just like, okay, yes, because I do recall seeing more current manga and being like, it is, there's definitely a different style that's in current stories. But yeah, I mean, for an older reader like myself, like, the datedness of this doesn't bother me at all, because it's not like it's dated in a pop culture way. It's not like I'm like, oh, they're wearing their hair like that, like everyone's got mullets or something, because it's the 80s. Like, there's not that kind of dated quality to it, you know?
I think it's kind of like Alan Davis basically draws the same way today as he did 30 years ago. And like, technically that's dated in the sense of being old, but it's also kind of timeless. Like, there's something about the execution, the approach, like the foundation and the storytelling that makes it, it doesn't necessarily feel modern, but it doesn't feel old. Like, if anything, like classic or something like that, like a hipster term for old, I guess.
Yeah. Because Davis isn't using kind of tricks that are of a time. Like, like Liefeld looks dated, you know, even though they may have been, I mean, Davis was before Liefeld, but still, like, an artist like Liefeld, like their style, like, really relies on what's happening at the moment. And, you know, it didn't really advance. So now you look at it like, oh yeah, that looks like the 90s. Yeah, whereas Davis just looks like Davis, Alan Davis, which is a different thing, I think.
Her art is so good.
Yeah,
I asked that because I was reminded reading this a couple of times. We already mentioned the color pages, but I was reminded reading this so much. Like, I love her art. Like, I love the parts that are detailed and beautiful. I like her fight scenes, her choreography, like her timing, like choosing what panels to use when. Really love it. And I think I'm biased. Like, I think I can't see some of the problems or some of the datedness with it, because she was such a gateway drug, you know, for me in comics. I think she was one of the first mangaka I actually read. I remember, like, her work would appear in the manga Vision, which was a print anthology, like a that Viz did for a while. And I think it actually had some of this, you know, single issues you would see in quarter bins or things like that. So yeah, for me, I know I have a block there, but I was just taken. Like, even the cover is so, mine's a little scuffed up, but so pretty, like like pretty. But then sometimes you get like an image and it's like so pretty, but it's like, you know, lovers embrace, but they're also covered in blood.
I don't see the problem.
Yeah.
Deb, Chris, and I told our Takahashi Secret Origins. What was your introduction to her work?
Kind of the same thing. I mean, they had the single floppy issues that you could get at the comic store. I didn't really watch the anime so much, but I loved the manga, the Ranma manga. Mm-hmm. I mean, to this day, like, when they reprinted Ranma and I reread it, it still makes me laugh out loud.
Yeah.
I mean, the comedy is just perfect. I love her work. I love her work in the sense that she does work for boys' magazines, like shonen magazines, and but at the same time, there's a certain feminine quality to it, a feminine quality to this, how she tells stories and how she depicts characters. It's hard to kind of put your finger on it because, you know, having a female creator draw for a boys' magazine is not uncommon. Mm-hmm. But I remember when I was growing up and I was someone who was interested in making comics, that it was so lovely to see and how natural it was that it was a female creator who was so successful. So to the point that I took it for granted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when I got, you know, I went to Comic-Con for the first time in 92, and I was like, oh, well, now, this is not then this is not the paradise I was advertised. And then it has all changed now. You know, I mean, there's, of course, you know, one of the best-selling comics creators in America now is a woman. Mm-hmm. And a lot of comic creators now are, I'd say it's pretty good. I'd say it's close to 50-50 now, mm-hmm. not more.
Yeah, but none of them have $70 million to their work, right?
Well, at least we have something to shoot for, right?
Yeah.
That feminine quality you mentioned is something else that struck me reading this, because there was a line where I think a girl is a girl. And then everything else Mana did in that story was like stabbing people, running off, piloting boats.
Yeah.
Like she very much pushes against, like she'll do the gender norms thing, but also the very sweet petite lady is going to be like very crude or violent or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's so nice. Like Akane Tendo from Ranma 1/2.
Yeah.
There's a part where her sister Nabiki is like, oh, she's a very nice girl. She's just horribly violent sometimes. It's like that's such a perfect description for a character.
That sounds like one of those quotes that you would put under your yearbook photo.
Absolutely.
I love that. I wish I thought of that.
There's also, I mean, there's nudity in this, mm-hmm. but the bodies feel more genuine.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're not fantasies of a body.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? And even like I keep forgetting the name, the main pirate lady.
Isago?
Isago, yeah. Mm. Like her introduction, she has the look that she's the dangerous femme fatale,
mm-hmm.
but not sexualized in any way, which is so rare when you have a character like that. Because usually you have a character like that, like, all right, like really cinched the ways, like have her kind of slide into the scene. Well, I've got a shot here of her in like in the rain, like holding her sword, and it's just like it's almost like film noir, but she's not a seductress at all.
Yeah,
like she's there with her sword, like shit's gonna get real. Yeah, yeah, and it's weird to recognize when you're reading something like this that I don't trip over it, but I notice it, and the only reason I notice it is because it's never done that way. In North American comics,
interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, is it Malice that's the necklace that women wear that makes them evil in X-Men comics?
Yeah.
And, like, how she also changes their clothes to be like leather bondage gear.
Yeah, okay. Chris Claremont fantasies. Claremont fantasy necklace.
Oh, yeah.
Fargo is another one where she has this very upper class, like elite feminine look, but then she's like, yeah, I waited 3 years to murder this guy because he killed my husband. And now I'm going to have dolphin or mermaid babies.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
It's so matter of fact.
Yeah.
Who they are as characters is like, it's not like, you know, they're to look sexy. They're just kind of, they're very matter of factly women who have.
Yeah. And
they're interesting.
There's also, over the story, there were two almost sexual assaults.
Yes.
Yeah.
But unlike, say, Watchmen, you know, they don't hit a certain point. There's basically a couple guys are like, yeah, you know what? I think I might do something to you. And then immediately they're dead or it's all disrupted. Like there's the threat of it, but it's not so much so that it's not a problem. It's not gratuitous and it's not like...
Yeah.
You know, to like prove a point or something and you know, turning into a revenge fantasy thing.
So weird because this is rated older teen and it was the surprise violence, like the intent surprise violence that would happen, as well as the sexual assault and the boobs and all of the nudity and things like that. And I was like, this has got to be one of her series that ran in like one of the older magazines, because she did work for an older magazine, Big Comic Spirits and Big Comics, which were seinen, like older men's manga, as well as Shonen Sunday, which is like a shonen, like boys adventure action manga. This was a shonen manga. This ran alongside stuff like Case Closed or things like that. Like real, like this, the intended audience for this magazine is 12, and you're like, whoa, like that's intense. And if we ever get to Umezu, it'll get even crazier when I tell you what the intended audience was for some of his work. But yeah, the fact that this book, which is like older teen, which is like 16 plus, I think, with the North American rating, was ran in a book for like 10 to 12 year olds that would buy it with their weekly pocket money. Fucking.
I would have loved this if I was 12.
Oh my God, right? Yeah.
And like, it's one of those things, I mean, this is a totally different rant, but like, if I'm, you know, 12 reading this, like, it's not damaging me in any way, really. Mm. Like, you know, there's horror, there's violence. The violence isn't that bad. It's definitely not worse than any kind of TV show or movies that you might, you know.
There's a lot of beheading. There's a lot of beheadings.
There's a lot of beheadings, but the cartoony nature of it, I think, offsets that a lot. Like, if this was like a realistic looking manga, it might hit a little differently. But it kind of, you know, as a kid, it would give you the thrill of seeing something kind of like quote unquote extreme without actually the damage of the extremity of it, you know? I don't know. I mean, my favorite memories are of sneaking into R-rated movies as a kid and like getting the stuff that you're not supposed to have. And this seems tamer than those.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, Goosebumps is really popular with that age group, right? I mean,
and Goosebumps is just tits all over the place, right?
I guess.
Yeah, it's raunchy Lewd Stein, right? That's the guy who does it.
Oh, that was pretty good off the top of your head.
Thank you. You don't talk about Goosebumps, right? You'll need the video. Listeners, go to the video for the visual.
Mentioning the fight scenes, it's funny. I actually don't think of Takahashi as a person who's really good at fight scenes. Mm. I think she's so good at melodrama, it doesn't matter. When I think fight scene, I want like the back and forth, like some give and take. But in this one, like when Isago gets, you know, like quote unquote killed, it's like one sword slash. And then the person's running away and she's already dead. Which is a very samurai movie kind of thing. Mm. Like, it's not necessarily choreography, but it feels like what that scene feels like in other media. So it still feels like exciting and correct. Mm-hmm. Well, I think if she'd done the type of action scenes that I prefer, it would feel a lot more violent.
Yeah.
You know?
Is that a product of the time, though? The kinds of action scenes you're talking about, was there anything that was contemporaneous with this, like in the early 90s?
Toriyama in Dragon Ball, actually. There's a point where his action scenes go from Takahashi style, like kind of more dramatic, to like kung fu.
Okay.
I think it's during the Goku and Krillin fight in the first run of Dragon Ball. And it feels like an actual like level up. Like it was good and now like, oh crap, it's great. You know?
Yeah, that tournament arc. You're talking about the first tournament arc, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting because I feel like, I don't know, even martial arts manga like Fist of the North Star and stuff didn't have a lot of that in my readings of it. Like, it might be like a movement or something, but it would be like one panel, right? And then like, dude would explode. It was less about intricate fight choreography and more about like just the most badass dude doing one badass thing. And that was kind of that. And I think that's changed a lot in manga. I mean, people are losing their minds about Jujutsu Kaisen now. The fight scenes in the anime and stuff. Sorry, I'm getting way off track. But yeah, I think that's very different. Like, I think she was in a different time, and it might be different now.
And different storytelling mode, too, I think. Like, there's a 400-page fight scene in Vagabond. One guy against 80 guys, and, like, he goes through the entire crew. It is like it was so good that like I didn't read comics for a week afterward. I was like, I just need a break. But that's like a certain type of story going for a certain type of effect. But what she's doing with horror, like the point isn't necessarily the violence. It's like the emotional trauma, like the trials and travails and things like that.
Yeah. And also horror is generally about the shock and the immediacy of violence. Mm-hmm. So the fact that like a lot of the violence in this is just like one slice or one stab or whatever. Like, I think that plays well to horror strengths.
For sure.
There's a certain, I think we were talking about it, that I think John Chacala said this, coined this term, but comeuppance theater. Mm. Where, you know, and this happens in Cat Eye Boy, and this happens in certain types of horror where it's like, people, really bad people, end up in a very bad way.
Yeah.
And that's kind of satisfying.
It is very satisfying. I love it in real life, too.
Yeah. Not only GameStop, you know, bankrupting a bunch of hedge funders. I kind of love that, too.
Man. You said this was called Mermaid Forest at first? Or was it like Mermaid Saga and then Mermaid Forest was like a separate thing?
So the titles in the chapter page are some of the things that it was called. It was called different things in English at different times as well. But people use Mermaid Saga and Mermaid Forest because that's what the OVAs, the original video animations that were made of this series, adapted. That's what those were called. So Mermaid Forest, the two-chapter story in here, was one of the ones they adapted, as well as I think the first one with Mana, they adapted as well. But I haven't seen those. I think they're still online, like Crunchyroll or something. I think they're still available. Yeah. I would be curious to see what they did with the character designs and stuff. I remember them being really tight. I have a funny story about the anime too, but yeah, I think that it was called different things. It was like Mermaid Saga, Mermaid Forest, Mermaid Saga 1 and 2, and Mermaid Forest 1 and 2 maybe. But now it's just Mermaid Saga. Oh, we didn't mention, while we're recording this, the second volume is not out yet in this edition, but it probably will be out by the time this episode actually gets it to viewers' hands. It's coming out February 16th. So.
Well, that's good. It's a great advertisement for Viz, who has employed two of you. So
weird. It's almost like that was planned.
It's a beautiful edition. It's worth getting. It's a good value. It's nice and thick. It's like $25 for this, like, basically double-sized volume.
Yeah.
But also that it is available in Comixology, too, if you don't want to get more stuff on your shelf. But it is nicely done. Has the French flaps, the color pages. I think it's worth getting. Even if you're like me and you had the old version before, I found it worthwhile to get it.
God, we get it. Go buy this Viz product.
I looked it up, and the name in Japanese just kind of translates literally to Mermaid Series. Which was kind of fun. Like Saga has
like... Mermaid Monogatari or something like that?
No, it's like Shirishu, like in Katakana. Yeah. And like Saga works better than series, even though it kind of means the same thing.
Kind of, yeah.
But
well, Saga has an epic feel to it.
Yeah.
Series is just like... Series kind of makes it seem mundane.
Here's a bunch of mermaid stuff I thought of.
Yeah.
It's all mermaid stuff I thought of.
Great title. Here's a bunch of mermaid stuff I thought of. Rumiko Takahashi.
Yeah. So 80 million copies.
Yeah. $70 million he's worth. I looked it up. Frank Miller's worth $25 million.
Wow.
And that's movies.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of DC money there, but yeah.
Yeah. Takahashi also has probably the coolest picture for any comic creator. Maybe second coolest, of her wearing a Def Jam sweatshirt in the 90s.
What?
Yeah.
It's super cute.
I have it up right now. I know that's not really good the podcast etiquette, yeah. But
the only one better is the, I think there's one of the Sailor Moon creator laying on a Porsche or a Lamborghini or something like that.
Those are the days.
Yeah, it's like,
oh my gosh, she's wearing a Def Jam sweatshirt, and she's like, 50 here?
Yeah.
Like, it's not even, I thought you meant like it was like a young shot of her in like 81 or something, but
yeah, no. She's that cool.
She's that cool. Wow.
And we are back with Manga Spellini. We had a really nice little chat about Mermaid Saga, but maybe let's sum up and see what we all think about it. So Chris, what's your final thoughts on Mermaid Saga?
I think, like I said, I really liked it. I really liked it a lot. But it did make me nostalgic for books I remember liking more when I read them, both by Takahashi and her, like, senpai, Adachi. I want to go back and read more Rumiko Takahashi now. And I think that that's great. I'd never read Mermaid Saga before. And, like, I just read little bits and pieces here and there. Really glad I read it. I actually want to read Volume 2 to see if it gets any kind of conclusion or if it's just, and they walked Japan forever. So I'm excited about... I'm excited about Volume 2 coming soon, and I do want to read that. So, yeah, I think it's not something I would have chosen. I thought our first horror manga would definitely have been Junji Ito, but I think it's a really good recommendation for people who don't read a lot of manga. So, good call, Deb. I like this one a lot.
Thank you. And David, what did you think?
I think if you walk around Japan for 500 years, Japan is not that big, so it should be really easy to find the mermaid that you were looking for.
But that's your takeaway.
But no, it was really good. Like, she's always a pleasure to read. And like Chris was saying, this made me want to read more Takahashi. You know, like, I've got Ranma, I've got a lot of Inuyasha. But I feel like the best thing a comic can do for me is when I finish it, wanting more, but then also wanting more of similar things. Like, I want to see more immortality stories now. I want to, you know, spend more time thinking about how immortality is portrayed in this story, how it's kind of a curse that everyone wants, but no one realizes it's a curse until it's too late. I don't know. It's just really good. It's really interesting. So, yeah, I'm into it.
I was really happy to reread this again. And like I said, it's been several years since I've read it. So it was some of it was familiar, when some, but I'm looking forward to reading volume two because I actually don't remember how it ends. I'm glad everyone enjoyed it. That's very gratifying. And Chip?
I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. And not only enjoyed it, but enjoyed it right from the get-go. There wasn't like 100 pages of me just kind of like, all right, when's it going to kick in? Like, it kicks in so quickly. Mm. She's clearly a master at carrying the reader along and keeping them interested from page to page. It's so funny, we didn't even talk about the horror aspects of this horror manga, because the horror stuff doesn't really, I mean, it didn't scare me. You know, there's some kind of gross things here and there, but that didn't feel like her strength in this. You know, the strength is in the surprises and the twists. Yeah, I loved it. And much like everyone else, I want to read more of her work.
Right, unanimous. Awesome. We killed it.
Yeah, wow.
So the big question is, what's next?
What do we do next? Let's see. How about, let's start with David. David, what's your recommendation?
I'm going to go left field again. I've got a rep for liking violent, tough guy comics. So.
Word on the street, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to recommend Wave Listen to Me by Hiroaki Samura, who did Blade of the Immortal, which was like a super violent samurai book. This one is about a lady who gets drunk and gets a job at a radio station and immediately gets in over her head. The short version is that a woman breaks up with her boyfriend and a lot of things happen and she ends up live on the radio, basically cursing him out. And the radio producer is like, oh, we've got to make this a thing. And it's sort of them trying to get her into the biz and her kind of being reckless and dumb and really funny.
Is it a comedy?
Yeah, comedy, drama comedy, I would say. Kind of like a relationship comedy. Relationship slash workplace comedy, I suppose.
You know, my main manga question, how long is it?
There are several volumes, but I think volume one is a good intro, and I think the fifth volume just came out or is out very soon.
Okay, awesome.
That actually,
it's set in Hokkaido, where we went to visit.
Yeah.
Is there a live action adaptation of that one yet? I think that there.
No, there's an anime.
There's the anime on that one. Okay, and it just won a bunch of awards in France. It's been out in France in print for a lot longer than it has been here. So, one of the ones I wanted to read. That's so awesome. I think that's a good choice.
It's sort of like if Garth Ennis did a Sesame Street comic after he finished Preacher.
So, Chris, are you just going to rescind whatever you're about to suggest?
No, I'm selfish. I have a selfish request. I actually want to reread something. Deb inspired me with enjoying rereading Mermaid Saga. I want to reread my favorite shoujo comic, which is called Paradise Kiss. This is the Tokyopop edition. It's now available as a one-volume edition, so that counts, even though it originally came out as five slim volumes. And it's I'm old, and so when I was growing up and reading manga, we all thought that Rumiko Takahashi's work counted as shoujo manga, as girls' comics, because she was a woman. We didn't realize that it was like, no, it's shonen. And when this was released originally, when Mermaid Saga was released, there was almost no shoujo released in English at that point. There was like one book of short stories that was it. Like, real girls' comics took forever. And, you know, credit where it's due to Tokyopop for bringing out actual shoujo comics. So I thought I'd been reading shoujo comics all these times just because a woman made it. That's not how it works, thankfully. So when I actually started to get into shoujo, I actually really liked it. It was very different. It has a very different visual language than shonen manga, and then seinen manga even. And next week we're going to read our first Jose book. Next week is Helter Skelter, next episode, sorry. And it's really, really good. But I realized we hadn't actually given Chip an actual shoujo manga to read first, which was maybe a mistake. So I don't know. We'll see. Helter Skelter, it just reads like a graphic novel that could have been produced in the West almost. So I think it'll be good. But I really like.
Let me just say, you haven't done a job at all of selling me this book yet.
All right. So that was my selfish reason for wanting to. It's my favorite. And I read it and it killed me when I read it. Like, I cried at the ending. It was so good. It is about a sort of a feckless young woman who doesn't really care about anything in high school, or university trying to figure out what she's going to do with her life. And she falls in with a group of misfits who are fashion students. And it's very transgressive, not only for Japan at the time, but even now. There's like a trans character. The lead character is like a bisexual who fucks everything that moves. There's all kinds of like punk, and it's like a little bit Bowie, a little bit Velvet Goldmine-y. It has so much going on for a shoujo manga, but at its core, it's like a, I love him, but he's a piece of shit. Like, what do I do as like a girl comic? And it really harkens back to romance comics, which I have some affection for, like North American romance comics as well, but is so much more mature and deals with some really heavy shit. I think it's great. And this, that the creator of Paradise Kiss, Aizawa, also did a series called Nana, which is also very long and very unfinished, unfortunately. So I can't recommend that one, but I actually kind of like Paradise Kiss better. So yeah, it's my favorite shoujo, and it's literally unlike anything we've read and are likely to read for a little while. And I think that that's, has lots recommended on that front.
Okay.
Deb?
Yep.
Well, let's see. I don't know if I, did I don't know if I mentioned it, but I was going to recommend Real by Takehiko Inoue. Real is about, Inoue did Dagobon, and he also did Slam Dunk. And this Slam Dunk was a manga about basketball. What Real is Real is a manga about people who play wheelchair basketball. Mm. And it's interesting because it kind of follows the story of these young men who, for some reason or another, can no longer play regular basketball. Like, they, it's cancer, their leg gets amputated and so on. And they discover the sport. And you can see the passion for the sport. And also you can see the pain that comes with going to rehab, the pain of the family, and how this tragedy of, you know, their circumstances affects the family and all their relationships. Takehiko Inoue is an amazing, amazing artist. Like, I don't think there's anyone quite as good a draftsman as he is, as well as a good visual storyteller. You can kind of, the way that he draws people and action, you can feel the weight of the body. Mm. You can feel how painful it is for these people to get up on the chair, how painful it, you know, how you can feel their real struggle. And that's kind of it. And the way that he tells a story is very, it sucks you in. It's not the same set. It doesn't give you easy answers. It doesn't give you easy, happy endings. It feels very real. But, it, you know, there's also lots of, there's moments of lightness and charm and humor. It's just an interesting and complex story. It's kind of slice of life, but I think it's full of compassion. Yeah, it's a beautiful, it's beautiful to look at and interesting to read because it's not as high drama as what we've been showing you before.
I will say the art will make you upset at yourself. The art is so good.
Are you trying to get me to not pick it or to pick it?
I'm just saying, you're going to read this and be like, fuck this guy. He's too fucking good.
I don't want that feeling. You're right, Chris. Now, this is the problem with me having to choose because I actually do want to read all three of these.
Mm.
So I don't know. Maybe we do this in a way where like this just determines the order we read them.
Hmm.
Because I don't want to disappoint Chris and Deb. But Garth Ennis writing Sesame Street.
Sounds good.
David wins.
I found my...
There we go.
You know what? I don't even think this is about the books. It's just David knew how to sell the book.
David is an amazing shelf talker.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, David and I have worked together in Image. And like, you know, watching David on a panel, the way he navigates and sells us to the audience and the audience to us, like he's very good at this. And the two of you have to step up your game if you're going up against David Brothers. Frankly.
I feel like every year at the Best of Worst Manga panel, honestly.
I get in so much trouble with those panels.
All right. The sixth is Wave. Listen to me. That's what it's called, right?
Yeah. Wave, comma, listen to me.
All right. We have, so for our listeners, next week we have Helter Skelter. The week after that is What the Font. And the week after that, Wave, Listen to Me, which is very exciting. Great. Do you want to do shout outs, Deb? Have you got shout outs? Is something you want to shout out? Something you love?
I think this is the only thing I have worth shouting out. Honestly, I'm not really doing anything else manga-wise. Thank God. I mean, you know, yeah, I guess there's... I will say that I just started reading something on Comixology Unlimited called F. It's a manga about Formula One racing. And it is an old school seinen manga. There's lots of nudity and gratuitous rapes and poop.
Any rapes are gratuitous rapes, but that's just me.
it's an incredibly old school seinen manga. And, yeah. and every moment, every minute I'm reading, I'm thinking, I hate myself because it is so repulsive. And yet I'm 15 volumes in binge reading it.
Jeez.
Go figure. <Wow.
laughs> Is it just like the letter
just F? Just the letter F. Check it out. It will make you realize how different seinen manga is now.
Yeah. I can't believe Fist Thruster used to be shonen manga. That's kind of crazy.
I know. God damn. When's that coming out, David? It's supposed to come out pretty soon, hey?
Maybe March?
No, I think it's this summer, isn't it? July? Or is it earlier?
It's summer.
Yeah. David, what was your shout out? What's exciting in your world?
So since you mentioned Paradise Kiss by Yazawa, I need to mention Black Jose Press, which is owned by my friend Jamila Rouser. Mm-hmm. She basically grew up on Nana. Like, Nana is her Sandman, her Watchman, whatever you want to call it. And now she's trying to make comics that, like, kind of give that same feel for Black and Latinx queer women.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So this story's about just, like, being alive and, like, enjoying what you're doing and having extremely messy relationships. Those appeal, blackjosepress.com.
That sounds awesome.
That sounds pretty great. My shout out this week is, I don't remember if I did this already, but I'm watching so much Midnight Diner on Netflix. It's based on a comic. It's based on a Japanese manga about a shokudo, like a Japanese cafeteria or a diner that opens at midnight. And just like the people that live there and they're, you know, the people that visit and they have little struggles. It's very episodic and it's, you know, there's a moral sometimes and it's a little cringe at times, but man, I love it. I love it so much. It is just like, it's sitting in a shitty but nice restaurant in Shinjuku and just listening to the patrons talk. And I miss that so much in traveling. So I'm spending a lot of time with Midnight Diner right now. And the comics aren't available in English. They're pretty good hit in France and relatively big in Japan too, but
I think someone has an offer in for that one. I think it's going to come out pretty soon.
Fingers crossed. It's a great, yeah, great comic. What I've read of it, but yeah, if you're on the Netflixes and you want to see what it's like to go to a small restaurant in Japan, that's my pick, Midnight Diner.
And you can also, there's also a website called onecookbook.com that if you get hungry while watching Midnight Diner. She has a whole series of recipes on how to cook along with it.
Oh, that's so cool.
I made the salmon with mushrooms in foil. It was yummy.
That's actually, I just watched that episode. That was so good. Oh, it was good. It involved cheating, which is, shocking. Chip, what's your shout out, bro?
I've just been reading a lot of Marvel comics for work lately. So my kind of downtime, my wife and I have been watching Kim's Convenience.
Oh. Great Canadian TV show, Kim's Convenience.
Yeah. It's a CBC show about a Korean family and their convenience store. And it's very charming. Very charming. If you like Schitt's Creek, it's like the next Canadian sitcom to watch. So, yeah.
That sounds
there
great.
There you go. Yeah. That's me.
Awesome. We all had shout-outs this time.
I know.
Well, until next time, we will be manga-splaining Helter Skelter by Kyoko Okazaki, and we'll look forward to talking to you then. Thanks a lot.
This has been Mangasplaining, episode number 3. Mermaid Saga by Rumiko Takahashi, published by Viz Media. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga Helter Skelter by Kyoko Okazaki, published by Vertical Inc. and Kodansha Comics. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangasplaining.com. Thanks to DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode.